And that means we are now on the final chapter of the course, not only of the unit, but of the course. And this final chapter is called the chromosomal basis of inheritance, because in this chapter we're paying more attention to what happens at the chromosome level. If you think back to everything we've been talking about from Mendelian and non-Mendelian genetics, we've really been considering things one gene at a time, which is fine. You know, that's a good way to learn genetics. But genes, of course, don't occur in isolation. Remember what a gene is. It is a subsequence of DNA nucleotides, part of a much longer sequence called the chromosome. And so genes don't move around or act independently of each other. However many genes are on a chromosome, those are like passengers on a boat. They go wherever that whole chromosome goes. They don't individually move around. And so that's one thing that's clarified here in slide one of this final chapter. There's no new information here, really. This is exactly the same dihybrid cross that we examined last time, with seed color, either green or yellow, and seed shape, either round or smooth. So we've already talked about the cross, but now we're drawing cells here with chromosomes in them to show you how things are happening at the chromosome level. Now, by the way, when we look at these two parents, what kind of cells are those as far as ploidy is concerned? Right, they're diploid. There's how many types of chromosomes shown here?
Two.
Two. Four overall, because they're diploid. And what about N? Well, what is N in general? What's the definition of N? Yes, but number of what? What's the full definition of N genetically? It is the haploid number, but what does that mean? Yes, one of each what? Chromosome type. So N is the number of different types of chromosomes a species has. And that was a trick question I just gave you, because we don't really know what N is. It's at least two, because there's two types shown here, right? The point is, we don't care at all what the other chromosomes, if it has them, are, because they are not carrying either of the genes that we're concerned with here. A seed color gene and a seed texture gene, right? We're just ignoring all the other. And almost certainly it's an N greater than 2. I just don't know what it is for peas. Okay, so we're just focusing on the two chromosomes involved. And by the way, it wouldn't even have to be two chromosomes. We're dealing with two genes, but there's two possibilities when we're talking about two genes. Those two genes can be on the same chromosome, or they can be on two different chromosomes. Here they're on two different chromosomes, which is why we're looking at four overall, because it's two types, but it's diploid. And as we already talked about, for these two parents to have a cross, they have to first make gametes. Well, gametes formation in a diploid happens by meiosis, but since each of these is homozygous, it doesn't matter which chromosome gets chosen. We talked about choosing alleles before, but really what meiosis is doing is not choosing an individual allele. It's choosing one chromosome or the other, or the homolog, right? But in this case, the two homologs are identical with respect to the allele that we care about. So there's only one kind of gamete this parent can make. There's only one kind of gamete this parent can make for these two characteristics. And therefore, since those are the only possible gametes, there's only one possible way to get those gametes together to produce a zygote. And that's why all of the F1s have exactly the same chromosomal makeup with respect to just this, these two characteristics, these two genes. Right? They're all double heterozygotes. Upper Y, upper lower Y, upper R, lower R, as we talked about. Then we get to this split here in the figure where we have the two boxes giving two laws. These are two laws that Mendel came up with, not knowing anything about DNA, as I've said here. But he came up with the law of segregation and the law of independent assortment. And we've really talked about what these laws refer to already. Law of segregation, as you see, states that the two alleles for the same kind of gene separate, which is what segregate means. They separate during gamete formation. So he recognized, even though he had no idea about chromosomes or DNA, he recognized from his results that gametes must carry just one of two particles that the parent has. That's the law of segregation. Well, when specifically in the cell cycle does segregation happen? Specifically.
Anaphase 1,
yes. Anaphase is the separation part, right? So you're correct in saying that. But remember, in meiosis, there's two anaphases. And it's anaphase 1 that separates the two homologs. That's what he's referring to. The two alleles for each gene. That means the two homologous chromosomes carrying those two alleles segregate. So that's when specifically the law of segregation is referring to. But also remember the important point that is when the ploidy gets reduced, right? Because each of those two cells is now going to have just one of each type of chromosome, one or the other, instead of both. So that's when it goes down to haploidy. Okay, and the law of independent assortment, of course, we've talked about because it has to do with independent assortment, which we've covered. Let's just quickly review that, though. What is assortment in this context? What does assortment refer to?
Close.
It's not good enough to say chromosomes, because chromosomes line up in mitosis, and there is no independent assortment in mitosis. Assortment is how what lines up. Well, let's pause then and answer the analogous question about the cell cycle. What specific part of the cell cycle is when independent assortment happens? When did I say that happens?
Metaphase 1.
So right before anaphase 1 that we just talked about. Okay, now what specifically lines up in metaphase 1? Yes, tetrads line up. Not individual replicated chromosomes like in mitosis, but homologous pairs of chromosomes, which are what tetrads are. All right? That's assortment. Since a homologous pair is two things that are not identical, right? In the cartoon versions we've been using, one's red and one's blue. Therefore, the pair of them has two possibilities, just like flipping a coin. Red can go one direction or the other, and blue's going to go up opposite. So there's two possibilities. That's assortment. Well, independent assortment says how one tetrad flips its coin is totally independent of how all the other ones are flipping their coin. In other words, the cell does not flip just one coin for all the tetrads. Each tetrad has its own coin it flips. And that's why the gametes are different. That's part of the reason. Of course, the other major reason is because before that, even, you have crossing over occurring. But you can see all these gametes are distinct from each other. Okay. Now let's take a look at 2. The cartoons at the top are fruit flies, specifically fruit flies that are members of the genus called Drosophila. And I'm trying to italicize that because you're supposed to capitalize and italicize a genus name. Drosophila is a genus that's used in a lot of different genetics experiments. They're a model organism for a lot of different experimentation for multiple reasons. One is that they're really easy to care for. They don't die very easily in the lab. So it's no big deal. You just give them some basic food and they do well and they reproduce. Probably even more importantly, though, they have a short life cycle. One generation is just a week. So in a lot of experiments, you want to go through a lot of generations to get good data. Well, you don't have to wait years to do that, just weeks. So those two things and other reasons is why they're used so much. Well, what we care about in this figure is one characteristic, which I'm sure I've already guessed, is eye color. So you have cartoons on the top, but these are real photographs of one eye each. And the two possibilities you see are red and white. This red color is the so-called wild type trait, which I've used that phrase before. Wild type means the kind that you are most likely to encounter in nature. And it's pretty easy if you don't already have some fruit flies in your house. Pretty easy to get some. All you need to do is leave a banana out for a while. And you're probably trying to get rid of them. But even though they're really small, if you pause and look at them closely, just with your naked eye, you can see their eyes, and most of them are red. But it's also possible for them to be white. Now, there's nothing new in what I've said so far. It seems like this is just another monohybrid cross we're going to look at, because we have one characteristic and there's two traits possible, right? But it's not. This is a special case that is different from all the other ones we've talked about so far. And that's because eye color in this group of flies is an example of a sex-linked trait, or a sex-linked characteristic, I mean. And correspondingly, we can call the gene a sex-linked gene. All right, first let me just define sex-linked. Sex-linked simply means that gene, whatever it is on a sex chromosome. That's all the phrase means. And that's true for some genes and not true for other genes. So think back to the human genotype we looked at. Any genotype would be fine, but the one we looked at would happen to be for humans, which is why there were 23 different kinds of chromosomes, right? But if you recall, we didn't use all 23 numbers. We labeled the first 22 pairs 1 through 22. And then the 23rd pair, I think it was a male, so it was labeled as X and Y. Well, that 23rd pair in humans is the sex chromosome. All the other 22 types are examples of what are called autosomes. Autosomes are chromosomes, just like sex chromosomes are. That's why it ends in somes. But sex chromosomes in species that have them, and not all species do. Sex chromosomes, though, are somehow involved in determining the sex of offspring. That's one of the things that these sex chromosomes do. That's why they're called sex chromosomes. But it's not the only thing they do. they're also just chromosomes, and just like all chromosomes, there's genes on them. Genes that do all kinds of different things. They just happen to be on a sex chromosome. All right? Well, the reason this is such a big deal is because thinking and picturing that karyotype again, all of the autosomes were truly homologous pairs. By truly homologous, I mean each of the two number threes were the same size and therefore contained the same number of genes. Not necessarily the same version, right? There can be different alleles, but it's the same number of genes, the same types of genes, same categories of genes, if they're truly homologous. But that's not true for sex chromosomes. In humans and in fruit flies, coincidentally, which use the same designation of their sex chromosomes and they work the same way for sex determination, the X chromosome is much bigger than the Y chromosome. Even though we say it's homologous, because it does correspond, they do correspond to each other. They're not truly homologous because they're not the same size and therefore they don't contain the same number of genes. Since the X chromosome is so much bigger, that means there are some genes that are on the X chromosome, but there's no corresponding locus on the Y chromosome. It's just not there. All right? Compare that to an autosomal gene. A gene that's not on a sex chromosome, but on one of the autosomes. For a diploid individual, that diploid has two alleles for any autosomal gene because it has two different chromosomes of that same type. Each one has its own allele. They can be the same as each other or different, homozygous or heterozygous. Right? That's all the stuff we've been talking about up to now. But if it's a sex-linked gene, then one sex will have two, and in the case of the XY system that we in fruit flies use, that means the female has two, because being female chromosomally means two X's. Right? She has two, so from that viewpoint, it acts just like an autosomal gene. She has two alleles, because she has two X chromosomes. But a male has an X chromosome and a Y chromosome and therefore has just one allele for that gene, whatever it is. And that makes a difference as far as how it works genetically. Let me go to the next slide to explain this in cartoon form. So in slide 3, we're looking at a cross that is deceiving because it seems like this is happening the same way that a normal monohybrid cross works. What I mean is that we have one characteristic, eye color. We have two parents that differ in their trait, so it's like a monohybrid cross in that respect. And it continues seeming like a monohybrid cross because when you cross these two, every one of the F1 generation is the same phenotypically. They have the dominant phenotype, which is red. Red is dominant over white. And it continues to seem like it's just like a monohybrid cross because when you then cross two F1s with each other, you have 3/4 of the offspring being dominant eye color and 1/4 being white-eyed. It is not the same, though. And you can tell it's not the same just by looking at that first row, the P generation. What information is in this listing of the P generation that we did not at all care about before?
Sex.
If you think about the first one we looked at, the flower color in pea plants, it was purple crossed with white, but it could be a purple mother and a white-flowered father or the other way around, and it would not matter at all. You would get exactly the same ratios because that's a Mendelian situation. Here, though, we have symbols for sex. This is the female symbol. That's the male symbol. Okay, so as I was just saying, a female, by virtue of being XX, is going to have two alleles for this characteristic. because it's on the X chromosome but not the Y chromosome. Well, she has two X's. All right? So she is, in this case, true breeding, so she's a homozygous dominant individual, homozygous wild type. The male, on the other hand, is white, is not only white-eyed, but the words homozygous and heterozygous that we've been using up to this point don't apply to him. Neither one of those words describes him. Right? Because homozygous means both of the alleles for the gene of interest are the same. Well, a male doesn't have two. It can't have both if it doesn't have two. And heterozygous means the two are different from each other. Once again, he doesn't have two. So we don't use the word homozygous or heterozygous in the case of a sex-linked gene for the sex that has only one of the one allele. Instead, we use the word hemizygous. Hemi meaning half. In the XY system, males have half as many alleles as females for sex-linked genes. Well, this affects him immediately because we're used to thinking dominance and recessivity, meaning the dominant one dominates over the recessive one. Well, if you only have one, whatever it is what determines your phenotype, right? So his only allele for eye color, which is on the X chromosome that he only has one of, is the white version, and therefore his eyes are white. Okay, well, let's look at the explanation in the bottom. After the word conclusion, this is just repeated. Everything above it is repeated, but showing you the sex chromosomes carrying these alleles to make sense of it. As I said, this female parent is homozygous dominant. This is yet another standard that they use for genotypes. Instead of using a letter for the dominant phenotype, like P for purple flowered, and then lowercase p for white, here they use a letter for the recessive allele. W stands for white, but if you put a plus superscript above it, instead of it actually being recessive, it's the wild type, which is the red. So W plus means red. W by itself means white. Okay, it's confusing, but that's just a different standard. So you can see that she is double W plus, meaning that both of her two eye color alleles, one on each of her two X chromosomes, is the dominant wild type red. He is hemizygous. This Y chromosome doesn't have the locus for the eye color gene, so he has only one of them on his only one X chromosome, and that's what makes him white-eyed. Now, when it comes time to predicting the F1 generation with a Punnett square, the Punnett square is a little bit different because before we didn't care about the sex of the zygotes. Each zygote, however many there are in a Punnett square up to now, could be either male or female. We just didn't care because it didn't matter to that gene. Those were autosomal genes. Now we're simultaneously paying attention to the characteristic, which is eye color, and to the sex. Because the gene carrying the chromosome carrying this gene for that we're interested in also determines the sex of the offspring. It's a sex chromosome. Okay, well, since she is homozygous, red type, her two chromosomes with respect to only eye color are identical, and it doesn't matter which one gets chosen by meiosis. That's why she's able to make only one kind of egg. Every one of her eggs is going to be carrying a red allele. That's why you could have made this two rows, but it would just be duplicating the bottom row. This is just shorthand. On the other hand, the male can make two different kinds of sperm. No matter what characteristic you're talking about, a male can make two different kinds of sperm when it comes to sex chromosomes, because he is, by virtue of being male, he has an X and a Y. Therefore, meiosis can choose either the X or the Y, and those sperm are different for that reason alone. Okay? So he can make an X sperm, and that will be, of course, carrying his white allele. Or he can make a Y sperm that's not carrying any allele for eye color. And when you match up the female's egg with a X sperm, you're going to make a zygote that is XX. The egg, of course, it has to be carrying an X. That's all you get from a mother. But if you pair that up with an X sperm, you're going to make an XX. And that's the left half of the Punnett square. All of those are by definition going to be female. XX is female. If you pair up an X egg with a Y sperm, then you're going to make an XY individual, though all of those are going to be males. And what this shows you is that 100% of the females should be heterozygous. And because of dominance, they should be red-eyed. 100% of the females. 100% of the, I mean, 50%, 100% of the males, I'm sorry, in the F1 generation should be hemizygous red-eyed. Okay, those are different from each other genetically, but phenotypically, they're all red-eyed. That's why it looks like this is just following another example of just what we had in the flower color example. We're not, though. Yes, all of the F1 generations are red-eyed, but for different reasons. All right, then you mate those. Well, the female is in the F1 is now heterozygous. So she has two X's, but they carry different alleles. And therefore, she can make two different kinds of eggs, right? She can make an X carrying red or an X carrying white. And of course, these hemizygous red males can make two different kinds of sperm once again. Their X is going to be carrying red, and their Y is going to be carrying nothing. And what you see in the Punnett square for the F2 is that 100% of the females in the F2 should be red-eyed, but half of them are red because they are homozygous dominant, and the other half are red because they're heterozygous. Right? On the right-hand side of the Punnett square, you see that half of the males should be white-eyed and half should be red-eyed. This is the other reason it looks like it's the same old ratio, but it's for a totally different reason. So yes, there are three red-eyed to one white-eyed, but it's because all of the females, which should be half of the total offspring on average, are red-eyed. Half of the males are red-eyed, and half of them are white-eyed. So sex matters on that. That is sex-linked. We can call a characteristic sex-linked, or we can call a gene sex-linked, because genes correspond to characteristics. Well, in slide 4, we're looking at X and Y chromosomes from a human, and you can obviously see in this actual photograph that they are not truly homologous, right? X is much bigger. Now, there are some chromosomes that are on both X and Y. And even though technically those are sex-linked genes, they're going to operate just as though they were autosomal because both sexes have two. The vast majority of genes, though, are somewhere on the X chromosome that doesn't have a corresponding position on the Y. And those are the ones that we really are concerned with when we talk about sex-linked genes, because those are the ones that have things happen the way they did just in this previous example for fruit flies for eye color. All right, slide 5. I think I'll make this the last one for today. We have just a sprinkling of examples here. This isn't by any means all the ways that this happens, but what we're looking at here are some sex determination mechanisms just in animals. Now, the animals are not the only sexual species, of course. There's all kinds of sexual species, plants, and algae, and so on. They all have mechanisms for determining sex, but there's all kinds of different mechanisms, only a couple of which are shown here. But we start with humans. because we're familiar with this already. And in fact, it's true for mammals in general, not just humans, that we use the XY system that we've just been talking about, meaning that there is one sex chromosome, one type, right? It's the sex chromosome, one of the 23. And the other 22 are autosomes. So notice this male here, as listed as a parent, has a genotype listed as 44 plus XY. What does that mean? He has 44 autosomes because there are 22 autosome types, right? And he's diploid, so he has two number ones through two number 22. That's 44 overall for just autosomes, plus his other two chromosomes are the X and the Y. He has two sex chromosomes because he's diploid. But XY is what chromosomally makes him a male. She, on the other hand, is 44 plus XX. Okay, well, since in the XY system, which is what humans use, since it's the male that has two different sex chromosomes and the female has two of the same, that means for the XY system, the male is the parent that determines the sex of the offspring, which you've probably heard before for parents. Right? And that's because even though the two X's aren't identical in a female, with respect to determining the sex of the offspring, it's not the genes that matter, it's the overall chromosome, right? And she has two X's, so it doesn't matter which one you choose, every one of her eggs is going to contain an X chromosome. And that means every one of her offspring is going to contain an X. She doesn't have any variability with respect to that. A male, on the other hand, can pass down a gamete that contains an X or a gamete that contains a Y, because one of his two different ones get chosen. And so he's the one that determines the sex of the offspring, because all the offspring are getting an X from the mother, and they're getting either an X from the father or a Y from the father. Therefore, the father is determining whether it's going to be XX or XY, which is the sex. All right, that's how it works in humans. The only thing that would be different for other species is that 44 would be some other number for diploids, right? Below that is a system used in some insects, including grasshoppers that you see here, which is the X0 system. Now, this is often pronounced XO, but it's really a zero because the zero doesn't, it represents nothing. Look at these genotypes. 22 plus XX for a female, 22 plus X for a male. So there is one type of sex chromosome, just like there is for us. All the rest of them are autosomes. In this species, there's 11 autosomes, and there's one sex chromosome. Okay, so N would be what? Twelve. 11 plus 1. 11 autosomes and one sex chromosome. Okay, but what's different is that there's not two different versions of the sex chromosome like there is for us. There's not an X and a Y. There's only X's. And what makes a grasshopper a female is that there will be two X's. She'll have two of them, which, just like she has two of all the autosomes. She's just diploid throughout, in other words. But a male has two of every autosome and only one sex chromosome. And that's what makes the sex determination. Then we have the ZW system, which we've already talked a little bit of because you did that experiment on the DNA of owls, thanks, which are birds. And so is this rooster. Most birds use the ZW system, which in a sense is just the reverse of what the XY is for us. What I mean by that is that there's two different versions of the sex chromosome. There's only one sex chromosome, but there's two versions. Z and W instead of X and Y. But what makes it the reverse of us, though, is that it's the female that has one of each, unlike the male in us. So females are ZW and males are ZZ. And therefore, in birds, it's the mother that determines the sex of the offspring, because she can make a Z egg or a W egg, whereas he can make only a Z sperm. So what would be the N here for this chicken?
Oh, right.
Half of 76, because they're diploid, is 32, right? 32 autosomes and one sex chromosome, 33 overall. It's another example of someone who has a higher N than we humans do. Okay, so that's pretty straightforward and easy to understand. The bottom one is the oddest, from our point of view at least, not from the bee's point of view, but that's the so-called haplodiploid system. In the haplodiploid system, which is social insects use this, including these bees that you're looking at, there is no sex chromosome. There's only autosomes. And what determines the sex in the absence of sex chromosome is the ploidy. Okay? A diploid individual, in this case N is 16, right? A diploid individual has, by definition, two of each of those 16, has 32 overall. That diploidy makes that individual female. A male has only one of each. A male is haploid. So the same N, but only one of each. That by itself is kind of weird from our point of view, but it gives rise to some interesting things. A female bee is unusual for an animal in that most animals, most female animals, can produce offspring only through fertilization. Only if an egg and a sperm get together, which is fertilization, right? Producing a diploid offspring, like themselves. Well, a female bee can make offspring bees in either of two ways. She can lay eggs, which for most animals would just be wasted if they're not fertilized. But for a bee, unfertilized eggs can actually develop into bees. But what is an egg by itself, ploidy-wise? It's haploid, right? She is diploid, that's what makes her female. And when she makes eggs through meiosis, they are, of course, haploid. So if she chooses not to mate, then her eggs will be unfertilized, and they will develop into haploid bees, which by definition are males. In other words, she can choose to have sons and nothing but sons simply by not mating. If, on the other hand, she does mate, then that's going to result in fertilization, getting two haploid, an egg and a sperm together to form a diploid offspring, which by definition is a female in this system. So she can choose to have daughters if she mates, sons if she doesn't. Also quite unlike what we do. But another interesting thing is that means that if a male bee has no father, okay, just make sense of that on its own, first of all. He's diploid. That's what makes him male, right? He has no father, because if he did, an egg and a sperm would have gotten together. That would have made a diploid bee, not a haploid bee, and that would be a female, not a male. So male bees don't have fathers. And they can't have sons either. Because if a male bee mates, if that's successful, that's going to produce a diploid zygote, right, from fertilization, which is going to be a female. So a male can have only daughters, not sons, and he has only a mother, not a father. But at the same time, every male bee does have a grandfather. Right? Because his mother had to have two parents to be diploid to make her female. So his mother is the result of two different sexes getting together, and therefore his grandfather exists. And plus, even though he can't have sons, he can have grandsons. Because the daughter that he can make can then just choose to lay eggs without fertilizing them, and those will grow up to be his grandsons. So it's a little strange from our point of view, but it's biologically interesting.